21st Century Radio is sponsored by Hieronymus & Company. Now more of 21st Century Radio with your host, Dr. Bob Hieronymus.
Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. These are the fundamental truths upon which our nation was founded, and they are illustrated by the new exhibit at the world-renowned American Visionary Arts Museum on Key Highway in Baltimore. Dare I say it, it's their best ever. Get over there the next free weekend you have and take all of your out-of-town visitors to AVAM to show it off. While there, do me a favor and stop by their incredible gift shop called Sideshow and buy one of my books that are on special sale at Sideshow in honor of their Life, Liberty, and Pursuit of Happiness exhibit. Call 443-872-4926. That's 443-872-4926 or on the web at avam.org.
I'm on a mission for the King. He told me to smile, and he told me to sing, and I can't get around here doing my
Yes, indeed. That's Slim and the Supreme Angels. They were my favorite. Indeed. What harmonies they had. Hey, by the way, at the bottom of the hour, we'll be joined by Quentin Wyatt to discuss the legacy of the Negro League Baseball, Maryland National Impact at the Benjamin Banneker Historical Park and Museum. Now, all you folks out there know that Benjamin Banneker was one of my favorites of all human beings. Well, for ever since I was just a little Dr. Bob, even when I was not even a doctor at all. I'm just a lowly PhD to begin with, so that's not much of a doctor, period, right? Okay. Our executive producer to this show is Laura Courtner. Of course, I'm what's left of Dr. Bob Hieronymus in this incarnation, and our engineer is Jake Bryant. And we are talking with Mitch Horowitz, A Cold America, The Secret History of How Mysticism Shaped Our Nation, published by Bantam Books, available at all major bookstores, or check out MitchHorowitz.com. And I'll make the big offer. Here's the offer. You go out there and you buy a copy of Mitch's book, A Cold America. Go to Bantam. Borders or Barnes & Noble. Yeah, go to them. Get a copy of that. If you can prove that you purchased a copy of Occult America, I will give you your choice of any book that I've written. That's how important I think this book is. It is kind of like, well, I wish we would have had this kind of a book all the way, from junior high. They don't call it junior high anymore, middle high to high school to college. It certainly would open up the minds and the hearts of students out there. Now, there are scores and scores of individuals we're not going to have a chance to talk about. I wish we would have time to talk about Frank B. Robinson, Frederick Douglass, Professor Black Herman, Marcus Garvey, especially the Black Moses, Drew Alley, and the Moore Science. All of this is in the book. But there is something that Baltimoreans should know about, and that's concerning the Ouija board. Would you please tell us, Mitch, what is the origin of the Ouija board and what's Baltimore's connection to it?
Yeah, Baltimore, in many respects, was the birthplace of the Ouija board. It was a homemade object among spiritualists, and the earliest reference I've found to it is from a newspaper in 1886, which talks about Ohio spiritualists using this thing that they called a talking board. An alphabet board that you could make at home with a carving knife and an ink brush, and you could make this little table that you could put your hands on, and it would float around the board and spell out messages from the spirit world. And people in Ohio, spiritualists in Ohio, were just wild over this talking board. Now you fast forward a few years, and in the year 1891, a group of novelty manufacturers in the city of Baltimore managed to get a patent on this talking board. They call it a Ouija board. A Ouija board. It's not clear where the name came from. You ask anybody and you get five different opinions, five different stories. But sure enough, they got a patent on this talking board, and they began to sell it as a toy, as a novelty. And it just absolutely took off. It became so popular that the artist Norman Rockwell satirized the board on the cover of the Saturday Evening Post in the year 1920. By the late 1960s, in 1 year, it actually outsold Monopoly. It had been bought by the toy company Parker Brothers. And today it's still sold by Parker Brothers, which is now owned by Hasbro. And you can buy it as a toy in a shrink-wrap box in any large toy store. But it is surrounded with the weirdest, most frightening mythology and stories. I have successful, articulate people come up to me all the time and say, look, I don't know about all this occult stuff, but I sure have had some weird experiences with the Ouija board. It just seems everyone of a certain generation has a scary childhood story about the Ouija board.
Well, you include some of those within your book. But I wanted to make we've had many, many callers over the past 20-some years mention something about the possibility of being a Baltimore link to the Ouija board, and it wasn't until I've read your material on it that you really set it straight, because it's much more complicated than one Baltimorean.
Right.
There are several that were involved, etc. But this is the book to get, friends, if you really want to know stuff like that, and especially if you want to know, if we had enough time, we'd be talking about William Dudley Pelley and the I Am movement. These are individuals that influenced my relative, Thomas Galen Hieronymus, and the so-called Hieronymus machine, which was not a machine at all. It has a lot to do with vibratory energies and healings. However, Chapter 8, this is really a great one. The New Deal of the Ages.
Yeah.
You included some really great stuff here, especially about Henry Asgard Wallace. What was Henry Wallace's most important contribution that you discuss in Chapter 8?
Well, you know, Wallace was a journeyer in the occult, and he was very honest and very sincere and very straightforward about that, and neither his family nor anybody who writes about him in history ought to compromise the honesty and the sincerity with which Wallace conducted his spiritual search. So I want to say that he was an exemplar of how to live with integrity. You know, he was a man involved in public life at the highest levels of American political power. He was Franklin Roosevelt's Secretary of Agriculture, and he was a great Secretary of Agriculture. He had many innovative farming and agricultural policies that helped save thousands of family farms during the Great Depression. He was Roosevelt's second vice president, and he had his failures and successes as Roosevelt's vice president, but he was a greatly inspiring figure who was capable of uniting all kinds of Americans from very different walks of life. But the beautiful thing to me about Henry Wallace, and there were many aspects of his political career that were remarkable, but the beautiful thing about him as a man was that even at the highest levels of political power, there was this decent, unwavering straightforwardness and honesty about the man. If he was interested in Tibetan Buddhism or Native American shamanism or theosophy or astrology, he didn't try to hide this. He didn't try to calculate this in some politically cynical way. He was a searcher. He was a seeker. He may have been our last great political figure who was just absolutely straightforward and honest about his own spiritual questions and inner conflicts. And I don't think he was able to understand that there were people in the press or other people in public life who couldn't respect, who couldn't take seriously that a religious search might take a man in esoteric or occult directions. He was just an exemplar for me of how to live with integrity. He had his failings, he had his foolishness, but he really lived with integrity, and he became my hero as I was working on this book.
Mine too. I've had the highest regard for him, and just got so tired of reading Westbrook Pegler's destruction of his doing everything he could to destroy the credibility of this great man, great soul. Who was so sensitive to many, and even you include new information that I've never seen before. D. dealing with his other, the possibility that he may have been another, a Native American and in a previous lifetime, etc. And that all makes sense now, that those little pieces of information and understanding why he cared so much about agriculture and how far ahead he was in regards and against agribusiness,
yeah,
which has, unfortunately, we got stuck with it in this country,
yeah,
now. And so there's only 5 different kinds of vegetables.
Right, exactly. And they all taste the same.
Eventually, yeah, they're going to look the same. But I mean, you know, that's what's so important about this groundbreaking work. Now, when we get to, again, we can't talk about, there's not enough time for Bear T. Spaulding.
Yeah.
Important contributions. Was he a phony or not? Well, and Paul Foster Case and his breakthroughs with Boda, Albert Benjamin. These individuals, you don't hear about at all anymore. And they're great mysteries to me, mainly because of my uncle, Thomas Galen Hieronymus, who had all of their material, had all of their research. And there were some things he wouldn't talk to me about them because he wasn't happy about them. Now, over the decades, I now can understand it a little bit better because, obviously, Guy and Edna Ballard were pieces of work, I guess,
yeah,
we call them. Real pieces of work.
Real pieces of work.
But there were worster.
Yeah.
There were worster pieces of work than that involved in this particular area, which we're not going to touch on now because why waste our time on those kind of folks from that standpoint as far as I'm concerned. Now, the President Lincoln, there's again, this is another good section in your book. President Lincoln, there's been a few biographies that have talked about his experiences at seances in the White House and that type of thing. And of course, I've always wanted to see references for this and everything and couldn't really come up with them. Now, did he indeed hold seances in the White House?
I think the evidence points to the answer yes. I believe he did. There's some connection of historical dots that are required here. There's some theorizing that's required here. These facts are not hard and fast because there are a lot of good, legitimate questions about the validity of some of these seance stories. But I really try to weigh everything, and I think that the answer is yes. And I don't think that it should strike people as a particularly far out or strange thing that Lincoln held seances in the White House, because spiritualism, for a period of time, was very, very popular in this country. And not everybody who became involved with spiritualism was committed to it in some kind of orthodox way. For some people, it was just an experiment. It was even just a novelty. It was just something to try. You didn't have to define your whole life or existence by it, and you certainly didn't have to leave your church or religion over it. And Mary Todd Lincoln was a spiritualist. There's no question about that. I mean, she was found to have frequented spirit mediums. She wrote and spoke about it very freely. She was obviously an influence on her husband. And during the Civil War era, the Boston Gazette, as I write about in the book, ran a report of there being a seance in the Lincoln White House. And there are holes in the story, and it's peculiar, and I try to weigh out the whole thing in the book, but I think the preponderance of evidence is that this did happen. And I think Lincoln used it for a political purpose. I think he was trying to show people during the Civil War that the commander-in-chief could kick back and enjoy what for many Americans was a kind of a novelty. It was just something to try out. Like Richard Nixon was photographed trying to use a yo-yo during the Watergate days. You know, it was just a way of trying to project an image of the commander-in-chief as somebody who could be relaxed during a political crisis. And Lincoln got his way, because this story of Lincoln's seance not only ran in newspapers throughout the North, but they ran in newspapers in the Confederacy as well. And the story was not a negative story. It depicted Lincoln as laid back, relaxed, joking, teasing some of his cabinet secretaries, asking them, well, maybe the advice from the spirits on how to conduct the war is better than the advice I'm getting from my Secretary of Navy. You know, it was vintage Lincoln. He was relaxed. He was just kind of a good-natured skeptic, I think. But I do think that these seances in the White House did occur.
Well, who was the greatest mystic who ever lived in America?
That's Edgar Cayce. He's in some ways the culminating figure I write about in the book, the psychic Edgar Cayce. Through his personal warmth, through his foresight, through his religious ethics, through his ability to help people from so many different walks of life, he's the finest legacy of occult America, and he laid the groundwork for our alternative spiritual culture, our alternative culture of alternative medicine, alternative healing. It's not for nothing that he's called the grandfather of the New Age. He really was. But what's so extraordinary about him is that he was a man who grew up in the Bible Belt, was a Disciples of Christ Sunday school teacher, was a guy who really didn't travel very far from the environs of his childhood. And in that respect, he was kind of a perfect prophet. He wasn't someone who went looking for destiny or for fame. And he lived most of his life in poverty, in fact. But somehow destiny and fame found him. It didn't necessarily make his life happier. It certainly didn't make him rich. But he was a man who did have some kind of gift, and his personal warmth touched people from so many different walks of life. Today, terms like clairvoyance, karma, reincarnation, psychic, everyone knows what they mean. You can't find an American who doesn't know what karma means, what reincarnation means. And to a very great degree, it was Cayce who introduced these terms and concepts into our popular lexicon. He completely opened up the religious culture of this country in all kinds of ways. He was a beautiful man.
He certainly was. Boy, and just anyone who's gone down to the ARE, the Association for Research and Enlightenment, and spent a little time there, well, can really feel that energy there. That
can't you feel it? That was my impression when I first visited ARE several years ago. I thought, this, you know, without sounding sentimental or maudlin about it, I felt that there was a kind of love there. That campus, that institute was a place that was built by love in a certain way. Mm-hmm. I have to be straightforward about that.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think you're right, especially the kind of love that's related to Christ, which is all-inclusive.
Yes.
And regardless of what kind of an individual you are or not, I mean, this is one of the great things about that kind of Christ consciousness. And you can feel it down there. Others have written about that. Now, we haven't touched on any of these, but I think it's important to focus a little bit on this. There are darker aspects to the occult and politics in America. Please tell us about how occultism figured in the start of the neo-Nazi movement in this country.
There was a figure named William Dudley Pelley, who was actually a very talented screenwriter and short story writer in this country in the 19-teens and 1920s. And Pelley was actually one of the people who introduced the concept of the near-death experience, or the out-of-body experience, into American culture. He wrote a very popular magazine article in 1929 about a kind of near-death experience he had in which his astral body traveled to heaven and he met these spiritual mentors, and readers were just enthralled with this story, and they flooded him with letters and said, look, I've had a similar experience. And this was one of the most popular articles on a supernatural subject that had ever been published in America. Within a few years, Pelley started to say that these spiritual mentors that he met in the afterlife began to counsel him in the destiny of one Adolf Hitler. And in 1933, as Pelley put it, these were his words, something clicked in his brain, and he decided that Hitler was a man who was on the winning side of destiny, and Pelley was going to start up an organization here in the United States called the Legion of the Silver Shirts. That was a neo-Nazi order, a pro-Hitler order, violently and virulently bigoted and anti-Semitic, and that extolled Hitler as a great world leader. And Pelley said he did the whole thing under the higher guidance of these spiritual mentors that he met in the afterlife. So it is an ugly and unfortunate fact of occult history in America that the nation's first neo-Nazi order, its prototype neo-Nazi order, was founded by a man who was an occultist and claimed to be receiving some kind of guidance from higher beings on an astral plane. And Pelley, unfortunately, was influential. He not only set the template for the neo-Nazi movement in this country, but as I write about in the book, he very directly influenced the anti-Semitism of the modernist poet Ezra Pound. Pelley had influence, And when you read Pelley's publications, there's not a ray of decency or light in them. It is just utter, rampant hatred. And one can only wonder what went wrong with this man. He was a talented writer. His articles were enthralling and exciting. And when he said something clicked in his brain, he meant it in the darkest sense. So that is the dark side of the occult in America. That is a very ugly legacy that grew to some degree out of the practice of this occultist and political activist.
And, of course, it made its way a little bit back, way back into America with Project Paperclip and at the end of the Second World War as we started bringing in various individuals who were Nazis, that mm-hmm. did serve Hitler, and they got their jobs at NASA.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And that's one of the reasons why I think NASA is not the same as it used to be in the old days. It's more or less a military organization now, even though we have the highest regard for what they've accomplished. Now, the thing that one of the other important things you've done on the last pages of your book, there are a core of set beliefs of the New Age.
Yes.
Could we review them as the last thing we do tonight? Because I thought these were really quite a splendiferous. If you don't remember them, I'll tell you, they're on page 257 to 258.
Ah, well, God bless you. I have a good memory, but there are times where there's only so much a man can be expected to do.
That's right.
one of the things that I write about in the book, in fact, the way I conclude the book, is that basically occult and esoteric religious philosophies left their mark on the religious attitudes of Americans, whether liberal or conservative, whether New Agers or evangelicals, whatever congregation you belong to, whatever religious outlook you subscribe to. There are basically five beliefs that you find very commonly across this country. The first is a belief in the therapeutic value of religious or spiritual ideas. The second is a belief that there's a mind-body connection in health. The third is the belief that human consciousness is evolving to some kind of higher stage. Fourth is a belief that thoughts in some greater or lesser degree determine reality. And the fifth is a belief that spiritual understanding is available without allegiance to a specific religion or doctrine. I would say that probably most Americans, to some greater or lesser extent, would agree with the majority of those statements. And that really, that's the legacy of occult America. Most of those principles and ideas entered this country in their earliest forms and in some of their most popular forms through occult and esoteric subcultures.
So how has occult America prevailed in the United States?
I think the American religion is basically a belief in therapeutic spirituality, a belief that spirituality should provide some kind of practical help and solutions when facing the problems of daily life. That is a belief, that is a religious belief that unites almost all Americans. And I think that belief essentially, in its earliest forms, entered our culture through esoteric and occult religious systems. That's the triumph of occult America.
Wow. What a book. Congratulations.
Thank
Mitch,
you.
I am so proud to know you. No, I am. I am. I mean, geez, oh whiz. Because this is an area that needed straightening out for a long time. And I'm sure you got paid $1 billion to do it, right?
Well, you can shave a few zeros off that.
This guy is the kind of work that you spend around 30, 40 years of your life doing, and you're lucky sometimes to even find a publisher. But, you know, you had the good karma this lifetime for some reason. What was the good reason why you got good karma this lifetime? Do you know?
Well, I have a good wife.
That did it.
You know about having a good wife. And,
yes,
indeed. And how that just means so much in this life.
Well, gives you meaning and purpose in life. And then, of course, to have a partner share when all these discussions with, you know, as you grow and develop, it's just extraordinary.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mitch, for joining us. Again, friends, the book is Occult America, The Secret History of How Mysticism Shaped Our Nation, published by Bantam Books, available at all major bookstores, or check out MitchHorowitz.com. And also, please remember, here's the deal. You buy a copy of this book, maybe buy two copies of the book, or three or four, then you give us your receipt, your at least copy the receipt, send it to us one way, and any book that I've written or my wife has written, it's yours. It's all you got to do is buy this book, because we want you to study this particular area. Thanks for joining us, Brother Mitch.
Thank you so much. It's really been a pleasure.
more pleasurable for me, I'm sure. And when we return, the legacy of Negro League Baseball with Quentin Lawson, and we'll discuss that. My special demonstration on the hidden meanings of common symbols together with a performance of the transformative music of Telesma, November the 14th, starting at 8 p.m. at the Wind Up Space. That's at 12 West North Avenue. One people, one planet, hon, after my presentation on how many common symbols point to the same themes of unity, balance, and a higher state of consciousness, you can watch a new mural created before your very own eyes to the tunes of Telesma. Selections of 40 years of my symbolic art will be on display at the Wind Up Space from November the 1st through December 31st, together with selections from the rock and roll celebrity photographs of Stuart Zolotaro. Seating is limited, so order your tickets today at brownpapertickets.com. Search One People, One Planet, or call 410-366-7722. That's brownpapertickets.com. Search One People, One Planet, or call 410-366-7722. November the 14th at the Wind Up Space. If you're a business owner or executive seeking growth yet determined to cut wasteful costs, consider outsourcing your whole marketing department to The Selling Well. The Selling Well offers businesses truly superior marketing services without all the overhead costs associated with employing a full-time marketing executive. Learn more online at thesellingwell.com. That's thesellingwell.com, named after one of our greatest symbols of prosperity, the well. Visit thesellingwell.com or call The Selling Well's managing partner, Plato Hieronymus, at 443-939-1890. TheSellingWell.com.
This is Hall of Famer Monty Irvin, reminding you to stay tuned to 21st Century Radio's Hieronymus and Company for updates on Negro League baseball stars.
Oh, welcome back. And boy, it's always great to hear Monty Irvin's voice. He taught my daughter how to hit, catch. As a matter of fact, yeah, right out in our own backyard. He was pitching to Anna, and was knocking the ball over the fence. Well, sometimes he did. It was so much fun. Oh, gosh, we've had so much fun with the Negro League baseball players and other Major League Baseball players. By the way, we're going to be, let's see, it's the 26th of October. They're going to be celebrating Brooks Robinson with the down at the Baltimore Symphony Orchestra and the Babe Ruth Museum, sports legends, etc. Hope you can join us down there. I'm looking forward to that. Well, our next guest is Quentin Wyatt, an advocate of the local Negro Baseball League players and an activist in preserving their history. Quentin joined us, on 21st Century Radio a few years ago to describe a special tribute ceremony he organized for Bert Simmons, our last living Maryland Negro Major Leaguer player, who unfortunately passed away earlier this year. I believe it was sometime in the summer. Yes, it was. It was mainly in the summer because I remember how hot it was there. Now, this year, despite all of us missing Bert terribly, he was such a fine soul, Quentin is involved in organizing something just as special. When we heard about the coming together of two of our favorite organizations, I got very excited. You know how I get excited about stuff. Remember last month when we talked to Peggy Seitz of the Washington, D.C. Benjamin Banneker Memorial Project? Remember that? Well, Peggy told us about the legendary genius named Benjamin Banneker, who is, without a doubt, one of the most influential free black men of the American Revolutionary times, and her organization's work to establish a Washington, D.C. monument to his name. And you know, he lived right around the corner from us in Oella, Maryland, on the outskirts of Ellicott City. So if you haven't had time yet to visit the Banneker Museum there, it's high time you did. Encompassing 138 acres, and containing extensive nature trails, the primary focus of the Benjamin Banneker Historical Park is the museum highlighting the contributions of Ben Banneker, the first African-American man of science. And this site includes a visitor center featuring a collection of Banneker's works, and a community gallery and a gift shop and patio garden. We spent a lot of time in that gift shop buying just about everything there was in there. I like carrying around my little Benjamin Banneker dolls in my car. I do. I carry them around in my car. And if you are a fan of baseball, then this Saturday, the 24th of October, would be the best time for you to visit the Benjamin Banneker Historical Park and Museum, as our next guest will explain. Welcome back to 21st Century Radio, Quentin Wyatt.
Good evening. How are you doing, Bob?
I'm doing pretty good. My pitching arm's pretty good. My slider is not as good as it used to be, Quentin.
Well, marches on, and we have it in our hearts. Our body just won't operate in the manner that we would like it to.
I certainly can't throw that ball anymore the way I used to. Why would baseball fans find Saturday, the 24th of October, at the Benjamin Banneker Historical Park and Museum be of interest?
Well, I think it will be of interest because we're going to promote an exhibit entitled The Legacy of Negro League Baseball. And that exhibit will not only have fabulous pictures and artifacts from the collection of Ray Banks, but it will also feature Luther Atkinson from the Satchel Paige All-Stars, Al Burroughs from the New York Black Yankees, Jimmy Bland from the Indianapolis Clowns, Eddie Banks from the Newark Eagles, Willie Fordham from the Harrisburg Giants, and also Jim Wheaton from the Harrisburg Giants. So it's an opportunity for individuals to interact with baseball legends. And these baseball legends won't be here that long. And it's important that not only the young but the old learn to value this opportunity to meet these individuals, to help support them in purchasing their signed memorabilia, because we have to remember that they didn't make the kind of salaries that Major League Baseball players make now. And unfortunately, not all Major League Baseball players know about these individuals or care to help to make sure that they continue to pass on that legacy about them. So it's important. But we'll have that going on that day. You will have Mrs. Leon Day.
Yeah, Geraldine.
Yeah, she'll be there. And also, I'll be love, Bert Simmons' wife, Orgy, will be there to talk about it. So it will be an interesting program. We will have a shadow ball game, weather permitting. And we'll have one of our board members will read the story of Roy Campanella called Campy to the young people, because it's important that we disseminate this information not only to those who remember the Negro Baseball League players, those who have an interest, but the young ones, so that they will have this interest and continue to support this interest and make sure this legacy continues to live on.
Well, this is super important because every year, when I first became involved, this was about 1990-91, we had something like 250 living Negro League, Major League Baseball players living at that time, and almost all are gone. It's super important. Oh, by the way, I don't think we mentioned that the legacy of Negro League Baseball and the Maryland and National Impact at Benjamin Banneker Historical Park, and I think we mentioned the date, the 24th, but it's also from 1 to 3 p.m.
Correct, 1 to 3 p.m.
1 to 3 p.m. And for information, you would call 410-887-1081. 410-887-1081. Now, excuse me, what were you going to say, sir?
I wanted to point out when we were talking about Benjamin Banneker, and I don't know whether you're aware of this, but a distant relative of the Banneker family had an affiliation with the Negro Baseball League. Were you aware of this?
I had heard it rumored. Tell us about it, please.
Well, it's not a rumor. It was actually Cumberland Willis Posey, Jr.
Cum Posey.
Exactly.
He's in the Hall of Fame.
Exactly. And his brother, Stuart Posey. They're related to the left side, but they're descendants of Benjamin Banneker.
Well, I'll be. Isn't that something?
Who was a manager, who was an officer with the Negro National League, who was a secretary with the Negro National League. As you very well know, his affiliation was the Homestead Grays and the Detroit Wolves. He was considered the father of the Homestead Grays and was an innovator in baseball. I don't know whether people are aware of the fact that he was the one who initiated night baseball games. Before anyone started to really have it.
Yeah. can see and, I can see that now, Quentin. That lighting system must have really been something, huh?
Exactly. And, and I think it's a really, truly a fundamental that individuals become aware of the fact that the Negro Baseball League introduced a lot of things that were not in existence in Major League Baseball at that particular point. The quality of baseball play was higher. They drew, when they played in the white parks, they had a larger crowd. If you look at some of the old newsreels, it was like a party. Everyone came in their Sunday best suits and everything. They had a caravan of cars coming in with celebrities such as Lena Horne. They introduced a lot of things. It was a matter of pride. And so they contributed a great deal, as in other areas, to the infrastructural growth of this country when it came to baseball. And Major League Baseball definitely became a better sport with the introduction of these players, with Jackie Robinson breaking the color barrier. So there's a real connection there in terms of not just Major League Baseball history, but just the history of this country in terms of the social awareness of what was going on in terms of segregation and integration, and how this did in the long run benefit all Major League Baseball players. And Latinos owe a lot to this history, and white players and Asian players. And I think people need to be aware of this, that this legacy of the Negro League is really large, and it really needs to, this message needs to be given to everyone.
Indeed. These were players that truly loved the game. I think most people are aware that certainly they were paid a pittance. I mean, we're talking maybe anywhere from $50 to $200 a month, and not too many made $200 a month. And the most important thing was the way they played, because there was only 15, maybe just 15 or maybe sometimes 14 players on a team. Each player had to play a number of positions.
Exactly.
And you were always in heavy competition with your own teammates.
Well, and they also had a rigorous traveling schedule.
Rigorous?
A rigorous traveling schedule.
I'll say. I mean, you know, these guys were often, of course, playing double headers, but triple headers. And even four games in a day, not in the same place, but going to other stadiums, maybe 100 or so miles away.
Well, not even 100 miles away. Unlike their white counterparts, most of the Negro Baseball League players also played in winter leagues, which meant that they were playing in the Dominican Republic, Mexico, Puerto Rico, Venezuela, and other locales.
Yeah, Cuba.
So it was more than 100 miles away.
Well, and I think perhaps what most impressed me was when my father, who coached Sandlot baseball on the field that Babe Ruth played, 29th Greenmount Avenue, Old Oriole Ballpark, which our house was just across the street from, alley from, actually. My dad used to tell me all the time, "Listen, Richard, if you think, because he was talking to me about the International League Orioles, and one of his favorite players was a guy named Rory Weatherly. I don't know if you ever heard of him on the International League Orioles in the early 50s. And he said, "Look, if you think this is good baseball, I'm going to take you to a game." So we went up to Pennsylvania into one of these coal towns, a steel town or something like that. And it was a white all-star team playing a Negro League team. And it indeed was the most exciting game I ever saw. But my great fear was there was going to be violence, Quentin, on the field. Because the people that were supporters of this white team were acting pretty much like the same kind of folks that we hear denouncing our president today. I mean, they were just terrible. They had no manners whatsoever, and they were acting like some kind of heathens out there. And those players in the Negro League, my dad kept saying to me, "Don't you worry. Nothing's going to happen. Nothing's going to happen." And I said, "But listen to what they're saying out there." And he said, "It's nothing's going to happen. Watch what happens at the end of the game." Well, the end of the game, it was like 16-3. And I think that those three runs the Negro Leaguers gave up, they gave them. in one of the last innings. And within 2 minutes after the end of the game, they were all in that bus and they were out of there. And they left behind a field of a group of white agitators who were just beside themselves, Quentin.
Well, I think one of the most interesting points about that would be, and my two mentors were Bert Simmons and Mr. Ernest Burke. And both of these men fought during World War II. Both of those men fought to defend free speech and all the liberties that we have. Mr. Ernest Burke was in the Moncton Point Marines, the first African-American Marines. And these men not only were great baseball players, but they were great men. They served their country. They came back to their communities, and they worked in their communities. Mr. Simmons, a great deal of work with baseball players in the community, the James Mosher League. Mr. Burke ended up being a tennis pro. And both of these men, along with others, they were fervently passionate in bringing out the best in what we have about this country. And it's unfortunate that in your previous description that individuals would have harassed them in the manner that they did. But they overcame that challenge. They showed what type of great men they were, just like Benjamin Banneker. And they continue to serve their country, to serve their community, and to serve their people well.
And they just loved it when they played in Mexico or Cuba or else, because they were actually considered human beings.
Most definitely.
And they loved it. You know, that was what was so sad about all this, to be so extraordinarily. It's something to me that when I think of Jackie Robinson and the years that he lost of his life because of the kind of stuff he had to tolerate, and he had no way of fighting back and whatever. But all of these other players went through the same kinds of things, and I think that's one of the reasons why I have an enormously high regard for them from that standpoint.
One of the things that I also wanted to mention, that and I did not want to be remiss in doing so, is that I think that it's, number one, I appreciate you asking me to return to your show. Because when I originally sent you the flyer, it was really to invite you because of the work that you do. But I also wanted to point out that it's extremely important. It's noted that the Friends of Benjamin Banneker and the Negro Baseball League of Maryland, which was started by Bert Simmons and his wife, have this unique collaboration with this activity. And in this day and time with tight fiscal management, it's important that that groups like this come together. And I think it should be noted that we are serving the same population, but we're serving different periods of history. But we realize the need to disseminate information to everyone. And it's important that we collaborate in this manner. So it's exceedingly important and noteworthy that you also find that this is important to do also.
Well, indeed. Well, Benjamin Banneker is one of my heroes, and for many reasons, multiple reasons, the kind of person that he was, which we're going to touch on in just a little while. And my producer is telling me we better take a break. We'll be back with our guest, Quentin Wyatt, the legacy of Negro League Baseball, Maryland, and national impact at the Benjamin Banneker Historical Park and Museum, Saturday, October the 24th, from 1 to 3 p.m. For information, call 410-887-1081, 410-887-1081. That's October 24th, 1 to 3 p.m. Next week on 21st Century Radio, the beloved Zahar Hieronymus returns to 21st Century Radio as we co-host together and update you on all the news and events relevant to our day. Don't miss a fun-filled show with Zoe and Dr. Bob, Sunday night at 8, 21st Century Radio, Talk Radio 680 WCBM. Have you bought a copy of Dan Brown's The Lost Symbol yet? It's a must-read for all listeners to 21st Century Radio. Not only does the plot involve all the latest discoveries and consciousness research we've been reporting on for the past 21 years, but, of course, it also relies heavily on the research in my two most recent books, Founding Fathers, Secret Societies, and The United Symbolism of America. As a matter of fact, right now, my book is being displayed right next to Dan Brown's The Lost Symbol in all Barnes & Noble and Borders across the country. They are selling so well that we are going into new printings. Please support your local bookstores and go buy your copies of my books and Dan Brown's new blockbuster from the brick-and-mortar stores. On October the 25th, you'll want to record the new Discovery Channel program called Hunting the Lost Symbol, which features an interview with me and premieres at 8 p.m. in America. That same documentary will also be seen worldwide that night on the A&E Network, where it will reach the international readers of my book that has been translated into Spanish, French, German, Russian, and Japanese. October 25th, Hunting the Lost Symbol on the Discovery Channel at 8 p.m. Don't miss it.
Hello, this is Lois Harris Powell of Chantel. You're listening to 21st Century Radio with Dr. Bob Hieronymus.
Welcome back to 21st Century Radio. Our guest is Quentin Wyatt, the legacy of Negro League baseball, Maryland, and national impact at the Benjamin Banneker Historical Park and Museum, Saturday, October the 24th from 1 to 3 p.m. For information, call 410-887-1081, 410-887-1081. Now, Quentin, for those who have no idea who Benjamin Banneker was, we need to back up here a little bit. Provide us with a kind of a brief biography of this great soul.
Well, Benjamin Banneker was the quintessential Renaissance man in American history. We talk about Thomas Jefferson, we talk about Benjamin Franklin, but we are remiss in talking about someone right in our backyard, who was Benjamin Banneker. He not only was a great scientist, he was a great inventor. He was a surveyor. He was a great farmer. He introduced a lot of techniques that were not being used in America during that time. He was a astrologer. He was a musician. He was a great writer. He wrote almanacs, which had single and double positioning algebraic equations, algebraic equations that dated back to early African history. So he was definitely a brilliant man of Senegalese royalty. And he contributed a lot to the history of this country. And we are remiss in not acknowledging this, even right here in Maryland and in Baltimore County. So it's wonderful that we have an institution such as the Benjamin Banneker Historical Parks and Museum, which allows us and affords us the opportunity to showcase his accomplishments.
With a minute or so that we have left, what is this I hear that they have finished construction of the cabin based on Banneker's original home site?
Well, at this point, we have a replica of the cabin that we feel that could have been lived in by Benjamin Banneker. We will have an official dedication November the 12th at 11 a.m. The county executive, Jim Smith, will make the presentation. And then we will have a birthday party, which will be the 278th birthday party for Benjamin Banneker on November the 14th from 1 to 3. And it will afford the community the opportunity to see this cabin, and it is wonderful. It is beautiful. And
did you say November the 12th?
November the 12th will be the cabin dedication with the county executive.
Oh, good, because I thought I had November the 14th, and that was the same date I had for an opening of my exhibit. So that's...
Well, the birthday party, the 278th birthday party, is November the 14th.
Oh, okay, but they're unveiling it on the 12th.
Yes.
Okay, so but people can get information or directions to the museum or by calling 410-887-1081, and that's October the 24th, 1 to 3 p.m. Thank you for joining us, Quentin.
Thank you.
And we're going to do everything we can to see if I can at least stop by on the 24th. We already had something else we had planned doing, but my producer is allowing me some freedom here. See you next week on 21st Century Radio with Zahara Hieronymus.
Powerful names in talk. Talk Radio 680 WCBM Baltimore.